Okay, we are now recording, and I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through the deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris, and welcome, everyone. As Chris said, we have a few questions already in the queue, but I've got a couple of things to start off with. One is a follow-up from last week, and you may recall that I have an Asus T100. It's a small hybrid computer, 10-inch screen basically, that decided it wasn't going to recognize large USB drives. So I have an external 4-terabyte drive and a 1-terabyte portable, which it wasn't seeing, and yet it was happy to see memory sticks when there were 8, 16 gigabytes. Once the Windows 10 update, the feature update to 2004 had finished, and I basically let it run all night. It was taking forever on my baby machine. Once it finished, then I found I could plug any external USB drive in, and Windows was quite happy. So the problem has gone away. I have no idea what the problem was, nor what the solution really was. However, there was another interesting little wrinkle. The reason I had to plug an external drive in the first place was that because my T100 was short of disk space. It only has a 64 gig SSD on board, and it clearly needed more for the feature update. And what happened was it ended up copying the windows.old folder onto the 16 gig external memory stick that I used. Interestingly enough, when I ran disk cleanup to get rid of all the old installation files, because I typically rely on disk images to restore things. I don't use the old version to roll it back. So to clear up the space, I ran disk cleanup, and to do that, you have to clean up the system files and look for previous Windows installations. And lo and behold, it found the windows.old on the memory stick and deleted it. So that seemed to work quite well. So if you ever have any problems with insufficient space, the secondary drive will work and it will clean itself up afterwards.
That's very cool.
The second thing I have is a Windows clone. So here's a version of something looks a bit like Windows. It seems to have kind of the Windows logo on the screen. It's running a browser showing our website. There's something there that looks like File Explorer. However, if you look carefully, you probably can't look carefully, but there are a couple of giveaways. Down here in the bottom right-hand corner, there's a power switch, which you wouldn't normally see in Windows. And this guy up here in the middle left says it's the trash rather than being the recycled bin. So if we click on the menu button here, the start menu, it looks, again, a bit like Windows. It's got Office. It's got a store, a bag there, which looks like the Microsoft Store. But clearly it doesn't have the tiles for Microsoft Windows 10. And anybody who's used Linux will recognize this as the Cinnamon desktop. So it's basically a highly customized version of a Linux distro. And my uncle, Jack Germain, says that this program, Linux FX, is the closest thing he's seen to transitioning from Windows 7 or Windows 10 to Linux, with something that's very close to the Windows desktop. Looking at the features of Linux FX, and sometimes it's called WinFX, and you'll notice it runs .exe and MSI files with just a double click. And so it can install Windows software, but it's doing that because this distro already has Wine, which is I always consider it to be a Windows emulator, although it stands for Wine is not an emulator. And it basically reproduces the APIs in Windows in a Linux environment. So you can install a Windows program basically using Wine. And then it's got a whole bunch of other Windows type features. But then if you notice further down towards the bottom here, it's got some bad things going for it. It runs Microsoft Teams, which personally I found to be a real problem. And then towards the bottom here, Steam and joystick support for gaming. So that kind of tells you that the author of this program, English is probably not his first language, because it's also simple and easy for use. And sure enough, it turns out this is actually I think it's South American, Brazilian maybe. Anyway, his first language is Portuguese. However, he has a highly customized version of LibreOffice, which looks a lot like this is the PowerPoint equivalent running one of our Q&A decks. So you see the thumbnails and the main screen and so on. And if you call up the Windows settings, then it looks, for all intents and purposes, like Windows 10. It's got system and devices and network and stuff. But if you look down the bottom corner, bottom right-hand corner there, you'll see that instead of having Cortana, you've got a utility called Aloha, which is his in-development version of Cortana, the kind of visual assistant, digital assistant. So if you're interested in Linux and but you haven't used Linux previously, it's kind of a neat way to move from Windows and at least try out a Linux distro. Okay, so that's all I have. So now we can move on to the actual questions.
Actually, before we move on, Alan, do you know if that's available as a live thing you could run as well?
Yes, it is. That's what I was running.
Yeah.
Okay. The screenshots are from the live distro.
So for anybody who's not aware, you don't have to overwrite your existing operating system installation to try it out. You can run it from flash drive or a USB drive or something like that.
Or a CD or a DVD.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you really like it, then you can install it, and you can install it in dual boot mode. So you can keep your Windows distro and just partition off part of the hard drive to use as Linux, as the installed Linux.
Yeah, good stuff.
Okay, so my buddy here has a problem with the printer port configuration. He resolved it earlier, but then it occurred again recently, and he was having problems setting up the port. So he thought he'd just use a Windows system restore point. But when he looked, there was only one restore point available, and that was immediately prior to a very recent, i.e. the day before, Windows update. So the questions were, did the Windows update basically stop the printer from working? Did the update erase all of the previously saved restore points? And when he had the original problem, was it the same thing? Did an update stop it working? So Chris has some thoughts on restore points and so on.
Yeah, the idea of system restore points is that if you have a problem, it can go back to a point in time for things like drivers and key Windows files and things like that. It doesn't do anything to your data, doesn't do anything to your installed programs, but drivers and Windows itself, it can roll them back to a point in time in the past. Problem is that generally it doesn't work to solve any problems. I've even talked with Microsoft people, and they said, yeah, they've never had a restore point actually bring a computer back to a working version, working condition, and they had to resort to other things to get things fixed. It seems to be deprecated in that Microsoft is de-emphasizing it more and more and more. And when I was doing a little bit of research on this particular question, I came across this quote, and I'll just read it. Yes, this is by design that the restore points will get deleted when you do certain upgrades. And the reason it happens is that if you have a bunch of changes and you were to restore something from a restore point, you may end up with a mix of files that could actually corrupt the operating system. So it might not be able to restore your computer to a state where everything is copacetic anyways. And so in that case, and I don't know if it's always or just that it figures out that certain upgrades will cause it to say, no, I need to delete the restore points so that you can't bring your computer back to an unstable state, or whether it just automatically does it all the time. So I really don't know, but personally, I don't count on restore points at all.
Quick question.
Yes, go ahead.
Restore points have fixed things for me multiple times before, but I don't remember if it was a Windows 7 versus a Windows 10. So the question is, could this be a Windows 10 only issue in regards to restore points? Because the answer is yes, restore points have saved my bacon more times than I can count.
Okay.
But I'm going back years.
Yeah, I don't know if this applies to Windows 7, that it will automatically delete restore points with any certain change. I have no idea. I haven't used restore points in many, many years, and I actually usually make a point of turning it off so that it doesn't, you know, end up creating a restore point that I'm never going to use anyways. And so, that's my experience with it.
Okay, this is good information, and it does explain a lot. It's just I wish I could remember which version of Windows did I last do a successful restore on, but it was at least a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And then since that time, I have not been able to find a restore point to do the similar magic, you know, the type of thing where the IT guy or gal comes in and the user says, oh, my God, it's broken, and then you do a couple of things, and 15 minutes later, more than 15 minutes with a restore point, and everything is back to normal, and I've had it fixed. It did work on Windows 10 because I had an issue with Office 2010 a couple of years back. And I already had my desktop on Windows 10. Sorry, it's all coming back to me. And anyways, I had a license issue. I had Office license basically go, I'm not responding anymore. And I ended up going back to restore point before a recent Windows update, and it did work.
I'm really surprised because it's not designed to do anything with applications. It's really designed around Windows itself and drivers.
I agree, but so, I think you also agree that if you have Microsoft Office licensing issue, putting it kindly, there's just no telling what triggered it and what may result in a fix.
Yeah. So
anyways, this is good to know. And I mean, I think this, and regardless of what I did a couple of years back, I think Natalie was asking the question, and I'd have to agree with you, Chris. I mean, given what Microsoft is doing with it, it would appear that restore points no longer have the use that it once did.
Yeah, and I think it's going to get even worse. I think Microsoft really is deprecating it,
yeah.
And I think you'll see it de-emphasized more and more, and maybe at some point the feature will just be stripped out completely. I'm not sure.
It should be, because it gives a false sense of hope. It did work at one time.
Yeah. Okay.
So, Chris, if you've got restore points turned off, like I have, it must mean that you, too, are relying on disk images to do restore when you need to.
That's what I do.
Well, that's the alternative, right?
Yeah.
I agree, but disk images over corporation, and I mean, I only have 45 units, so it's not that big of a deal, but still, that would add a lot more work.
That's huge.
I tried to do images on a regular basis, and I haven't yet to recover from an image, so I stopped doing it.
Yeah.
So Lawrence, I actually have another question in the chat window here about the 2.2.04 update of Windows 10 and whether people have it installed with a solid state drive. And if so, have you turned off the defrag function? Now I have 2004 and a couple of machines that both have the SSDs. I must admit, I assume that they would have left defrag turned off, but I haven't checked. I have to.
In actual fact, they don't turn it off, but what Windows 10 should do, and what most people report it does do, is it actually just does a trim function rather than actually doing a defrag. Now, there was some articles out there recently that said that 2004 actually caused, in some cases, actual defrag to happen, and as well, it didn't flag it as having been run, and so basically every time you ran your computer, it would run the defrag. I suspect that that is actually a very small minority. I haven't read, you know, any stats that have been coming out as to seeing how many people are actually affected. If you're concerned about it, then certainly the idea of turning off defrag until such time as we get word that it's truly been fixed is probably not a bad idea. And I actually did that on my system. But if it's turned on an SSD, it looks like it's doing a defrag. It's actually just doing the trim function, or should be.
Well, and further to that point, there's the whole argument of whether it should be done, period, on SSD drives, because it's not a platter type random. Sorry, the words escape me. But anyways, we're not dealing with the same thing that we did with the old mechanical drives.
Yeah, definitely. It should not be run on an SSD.
So why Microsoft even thought it would be a good idea at all is interesting in its own right.
Well, I don't think they ever did. They always thought that defragging an SSD is not something that should be done. And the OS is designed to not do a defrag on an SSD and, in actual fact, just run the trim function, which frees up some stuff. So Microsoft has never, other than mistakenly, it seems, in 2004, that some people were having defragging actually happening. But why it was happening, nobody seems to know at this point in time.
Okay.
And if anybody doesn't understand what we're talking about in terms of defragging, the idea is that you take various bits of a file and lump them together on a hard drive. Because if the disk has to spin underneath the head, or if the head has to move across to a different track on the disk before it can read the next piece of the file, that takes a long time in computer time. So by defragging, you basically put all of the bits of the file under the head as the disk moves under it, essentially. As opposed to a solid state drive, which is essentially random access memory. It doesn't matter where the next piece of the file is. It just uses the address and finds that bit of the file. And it takes the same time wherever it is in the memory.
Alan, I'm just going to take over for just a second.
Yep.
And so if you go on to, if you go to your start and you just type in disk defrag, it'll come up with defrag drives or something like that. And it'll bring you to this screen. And so it says optimized drives, and you'll see my solid-state drive is drive C. It was never run, and it says it needs optimization. If I turn that on, what it should actually do is the trim function, which just it's harmless, and it can actually help. I'm not sure exactly what trim does. Somebody else can jump in if they want. The other ones I have here are hard disk drives, and I just turned it off totally. You know, until such time as I hear that they fix this problem that came out with 2004. But you can see here that current status is all, and it says 0% fragmented rather than, you know, anything else. So even though it says that it needs optimization on the drive C, it's not actually going to run a defrag on it because it knows it's a solid-state drive.
Now, interesting, on my 1909 version, it does state that, hey, yes, you have a solid state drive, and yes, we do run defragmentation.
So, yeah, but as I say, it shouldn't run that. It is designed to run the trim function as opposed to actually doing a defrag.
Right.
That's, you know, I don't know why they word it that way, because it certainly looks like, yeah, they're going to run a defrag, and, oh, you better turn it off because it's bad on a solid state drive, and it is. But they've always stated it that way. But my understanding is it never actually does.
So you think that there's a bit of misinformation for the sake of a headline?
No, I think that the 2004, some people are having solid-state drives actually defragged. Mm-hmm. It's enough smart people that I trust that, you know, they understand what is really going on. So I think there is a programming error somewhere in it, and I think it will be fixed. But Microsoft has not talked about this publicly, apparently. To my knowledge, Microsoft has not said anything publicly about it.
Microsoft rarely says stuff publicly about some...
Well, usually they do after they fix it.
Well, yes, okay, fine. That's fair.
Okay, Alan, you can take it over again.
Okay. Okay, so moving along, now we have a question for everyone to think about these things. The gentleman here wants to download and run JavaScript, and he's got a game called Farkle, which he's getting from GitHub. Now, he's going to run them in Chrome or Chromium browsers and Linux or Chromebooks. Here's the thing. I expect these scripts to operate without trying to attack my system, i.e. accessing or downloading external links or scripts. Can you suggest any open source or free software that can scan for vulnerabilities in downloaded scripts and HTML files? If such software is not available, can you suggest a complete list of JavaScript statements that might be misused by malicious software to attack my system? The game also uses cascading style sheets, CSS files. Can malicious code be embedded in these files? If so, when scanning for JavaScript and HTML, do the same thing work on CSS files? And finally, the game uses images stored as PNG. Can malicious code be embedded in PNG files? And if so, can you recommend a scanner that will find any malicious code in PNG files? So again, Chris has got a number of suggestions.
Yeah, I think it all comes down to the idea that malicious code, you're worried about malicious code in files. So one solution I think could be uploading it to virustotal.com, and it'll be checked by some 60-odd antivirus packages, all with up-to-date signature files. And so if even one of them on virustotal.com flags it as being malware or possible malware, I wouldn't run it. I would probably upload it a couple of days later. If it's still just one and it's the same company, then I'd probably look at it as being a false positive. But if it is malware that is embedded in it, whatever it is, HTML code, cascading style sheets, your JavaScript, then if it is malware, you'll probably see over the next day or two that an increasing number of the engines at VirusTotal will suddenly be flagging it as being malware. And then you're pretty certain that it is malware at that point in time. I have here scanning with any antivirus package, but essentially that's what you're doing with VirusTotal. And with VirusTotal, you have about 60 different antivirus packages. So I would just use VirusTotal, I think. In terms of saying if there's nothing that is necessarily going to catch it, what are the JavaScript programming structures that could do malicious things? And I think that you're getting into a really, really difficult thing to ask for, because personally, I don't, you know, any programming language at all that has any sort of robustness, there's a lot that it could do that would be malicious actions. I think the fact that it is on GitHub is probably a good thing, in that I think a lot of people use GitHub and a lot of people look at things that are on GitHub. But personally, yeah, I think just the idea of uploading it to virustotal.com, that's the best that I would be able to do. I don't know. For the PNG files, a PNG file is a graphic file, and by itself it cannot hold executable code. But that's not to say you're out of the woods necessarily. So if the program that you use to render the graphic on your computer, whether it's a photo editor, a photo viewer, a game that is going to display this particular graphic, if that has a vulnerability, it is possible for the PNG, the graphic itself, to have bits in it that will trigger that particular vulnerability. And this has actually happened in the past. So something that where a PNG file in specifically, and other graphic files have been affected the same way, where the file itself is not malicious, but it triggers a vulnerability in some software that you're running on your computer. So for CSS cascading style sheets, I think that's much the same thing. They don't host executable code, but you know they can be launched by something else that could be triggering some sort of malicious action. So I think that the end result of all of this is that, yes, you can check things against multiple antivirus engines to see if they seem to have anything bad about them, but you want to stay up to date on your security patches on all the software on your computer, Windows itself, and all of the programs that you've got installed on your computer. Windows Update will do a wonderful job of looking after the security updates for anything from Microsoft. For everything else, the programs themselves might have auto-update capabilities built into them. If so, by all means, use them. If not, or even if they do, the best that I've found currently for free software out there, there's Sumo and Dumo, so Software Update Monitor and Driver Update Monitor from KC Softwares, that's plural softwares. And so it can do a check on your system. Now, one of the things I want to point out, though, is that Sumo and Dumo are update managers. They're not vulnerability managers. So they will tell you that a newer version of a program is available, but they won't tell you if it fixes security vulnerabilities or it's just a new version of the program or it fixes other general bug fixes. So if I have a program on my computer, say PaintShop Pro version X16, it might tell me X17 is available, so you're out of date. Well, I don't know if X16 has security vulnerabilities or they're just telling me there's something new out there that I'm probably going to have to pay for. So, but it will give you a bit of a running start at things. If you actually want vulnerability management, which I much prefer, you might want to consider VulnDetect. And the reason why I say might is that it's still in beta. It's been in beta for about 2 years now, I believe, or a year and a half at least. It was promised that a 1.0 release would come out in September last year. But it's a good program. I've been using it. It was put out by the people who used to work for the company that wrote Personal Software Inspector, which was a fantastic vulnerability management program. It actually could monitor the status of about 20,000 programs, and if you were running any of them, it could check to see if the version that you're running has a security vulnerability and if a patch is available. And in most cases, it could install the patch automatically. VulnDetect is not quite as nice as Personal Software Inspector was, but it is a vulnerability detection program. So it is specifically looking for security vulnerabilities. So it's still in beta, but it seems to be working quite well, and they are actively developing it. I get an email once a week telling me what new things they fixed or new detections they've added. And personally, I actually do use it. So your mileage may vary, but I think that's not a bad idea.
So I had a couple of thoughts too. As Chris mentioned, HTML doesn't by itself host executable code. It's a markup language, so you're tagging words and the browser is interpreting those tags. But both HTML and CSS can launch JavaScript and other kinds of scripting languages. So if you look on Google and search for JavaScript scanners and that sort of thing, you'll turn up a whole bunch of tools. And I found a couple of things. One of them is 9 different tools for website malware scanning, fairly recent, May this year. And also a company, Securi Website Monitoring, that will actually scan an entire website. So you basically type in your URL, and it does a scan of the site. So things like that are certainly out there. I haven't tried any of them, so I can't recommend any particular thing, but they're free, so they're worth looking at. And the other thought I had was, how about running this game in a sandbox and seeing what happens? Because if it's going to launch external websites that you weren't expecting, and you should see that happening in your browser. But if it's in the sandbox, it shouldn't be affecting the rest of your computer. So I would have thought that was another possibility.
I'll interject just a little bit on there. And while I think running something in a sandbox is a great idea, the absence of evidence of malicious intent does not necessarily mean that there's no malicious intent. You might just not see what's going on. Or there's also the possibility that a lot of malware will actually check to see if it's running in a sandbox and not trigger anything if it sees that, yes, indeed, it's in a sandbox. It might be a security analyst that's looking at it. So it may pick up some stuff, and that's great if it does. But if it doesn't pick up something, it doesn't necessarily mean that things are safe. Personal opinion. Feel free to jump in and argue with me on that if you want. I don't mind.
I say there's nothing in the chat window, but does anybody have any other thoughts about how to deal with all of the above? Otherwise, we're going to be moving along. Don't forget you have to unmute your mic if you want to chip in. Okay, well, we'll just move on then. So our next question is about a virtual private network, a Bitdefender Premium, but the member doesn't think she's using it properly, and she's noticed it got some really bad reviews. The subscription's coming up in a week and wonders if you have any recommendations about keeping it or how to use it effectively, I guess. So again, Chris had some thoughts on this earlier, and we're going to revisit them.
Yeah, so VPN is a virtual private network, and essentially what it means is that all the internet or all of the network traffic from your computer will go, rather than going directly as in the diagrams in here of the red arrows, where it will go to the individual services that you're connecting to out on the internet. Instead, it will go over the teal, I guess, arrows, where all your traffic will go from your internet gateway, your router or your modem, and it will go to the VPN server, and then it goes from the VPN server out to all of the individual servers that you're trying to connect to. And returning traffic will go back to the VPN server and then get routed back to you. And I point out that those are encrypted tunnels that are between your computer and the VPN server. So that means if anybody's trying to sniff the traffic, either on wires or wireless, if you're on wireless, they won't be able to decipher what the traffic is, where it's going, or anything like that. Including your ISP. So on the good side, if you want to evade geo-blocking, so if you go to a website and says that, oh, this content is not available in your country, This can get around it by going to a VPN server that is in that particular country, and then all the traffic that goes to that service appears to be coming from that is coming from that country. Encrypting all your traffic while you are on Wi-Fi definitely is a useful function of it. And because the ISP doesn't even know where your traffic is trying to go, it's just seeing that all your traffic is going to the VPN server somewhere else in the world. If your ISP is starting to block services or destinations, it can evade that. On the bad side, if you think it does anything more than that, that's a bad thing, because you should not assume it to be, it's not a security thing, really, other than the encrypting of the Wi-Fi of the traffic. It really doesn't do anything to add to your security. Generally, it costs money. Very few VPN services out there that are free. There is one called Tunnel Bear that is actually run out of, I believe, Toronto. And they will give you something like 500 megabytes a month free. And if you want more than that, you have to pay. There are a lot of other services out there that you can pay for. Rather than might slow access, I would say that it almost certainly is going to slow access, only in that it is adding a hop. You know, rather than you going directly to, you know, Google or Facebook or whatever, you're going to the VPN server and then from the VPN server to Google or Facebook. So it is adding another hop into the link there. And there are countries where it is illegal for you to use VPN services. So if you have a laptop and you're traveling, I would be very, very careful to check with the country of destination whether even having it installed on your computer might be considered a crime. And a couple of them there, China, Russia, Iran, sound like, you know, the sort of places you would expect it. There are other ones that you might not consider to be you know, on a list like that. You know, might be, who knows, Argentina or something like that. So there are some friendlier countries as well where it is illegal. So I highly recommend that you check.
And a couple of things there. I guess most people would use it for either geo-blocking to watch television programs in a different country, and or the encryption on Wi-Fi. And yeah. By that, I guess you mean home Wi-Fi, which would stop your neighbors or somebody parked outside your house sniffing your traffic. But more importantly, if you're on a public hotspot, such as a coffee shop or a library or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. A nice thing about going to something like Tunnel Bear is that if all you want is for, you know, when you're in the Wi-Fi hotspot, you know, you just want, you know, your traffic not to be sniffed, you can leave it turned off most of the time and then only turn it on. There's a little tray icon for it, and turn it on when you need it, and 500 megabytes a month might be more than enough for you, and you can do it for free.
So anybody have any other thoughts about that Bitdefender Premium in particular?
Well, Alan, you said something. You mentioned about someone sniffing your traffic if they were outside your house. So the comment to that is that they would have had to hack into your router for them to actually watch that traffic, because them scanning the wireless signal from outside of your house, your traffic is encrypted between your laptop and the router. So therefore, yes, should be. And therefore, it is not likely to be able to sniff or a man-in-the-middle type of attack being done. That said, if they have access to your router, you have bigger issues.
Yeah.
You know, Bob Walker here. A couple of years ago, I tried the Avast SecureLine VPN on one of my computers, my main computer, and did a great job. But it was ridiculously expensive. So I switched over to NordVPN, which for less than half the price allowed me to put it on 5 machines. And it does a fairly good job. Now, in terms of geo-blocking, companies like Netflix and all that have developed technologies to sniff out whether you're using a VPN. And of course, companies like NordVPN have come up with technologies to randomize it so that Netflix's sniffers can't quite catch it anymore. So it's an ongoing battle as to how well that works. As Alan mentioned, one of the premium or big things to use a VPN for is if you're in a Wi-Fi hotspot, it encrypts your traffic so that other people at the hotspot can't hack into it. But one of the issues with some of the VPNs, including NordVPN, is that websites like Costco or Home Depot and a few others don't play well with VPNs. If you want to go to your Home Depot website or your Costco website, you might have to turn your VPN off. So it's a mixed blessing.
Sorry. So basically, if you're not interested in geo-blocking or evading ISP blocking, then you really don't need it if you just normally use your laptop at home.
That's certainly the way I would look at it, yeah.
Awesome. Okay. Thank you.
I mean, they can't make for evading geo-blocking, as Alan said, that's probably what most people use it for. And my understanding with Netflix is they really don't care. If you come in, they figure they've done due diligence in making sure that the originating IP address is in the United States. And the content that you get for Netflix in the States, it's not necessarily that much more than Canada, but it is different. And so there are some shows in that you can only get if you're coming from a U.S. address. And so a lot of people will use it for that, and they definitely feel that it is worth their while. But, yeah, if you're not interested in geo-blocking and you're not interested in, being able to encrypt your Wi-Fi when you're on a public Wi-Fi spot in particular, then, I wouldn't bother. Certainly wouldn't bother spending money on it.
No, that's what I'm asking. The geo-blocking, Chris, you're right in that Netflix really doesn't give a damn whether you're coming in from somewhere else. However, a lot of the license holders that license their material to Netflix do care quite a bit, and they put enough pressure on Netflix that Netflix at least has to put in a good show of trying to block geo-blocking.
Oh, that's interesting.
So they make a token effort. So if you're using a cheap VPN, then they're going to try and kick you out. But if you're using one of the ones that randomizes things, so it doesn't all, they don't get, Netflix doesn't get like 50,000 requests from the same server, it's not so much of an issue.
Yeah, true.
So Natalie's asking for a limited VPN on a public hotspot. Don't most antivirus programs provide that service bundled with the program? I think not.
No, I think you're correct in that most of them will probably consider it to be a separate product that they charge separately for. You might get it as, bundled in as an all-encompassing suite of security products like firewall, antivirus, anti-spyware, and VPN might be bundled in with it. So there's certainly that possibility on there. But so if you're happy with a particular antivirus product and it happens to include it as part of their suite, then sure, why not? It doesn't hurt to have it, other than the bad things that are listed on the deck as you see it right now.
Bob Walker here. I mentioned I tried Avast SecureLine VPN a couple of years ago and it worked wonderfully, but I dropped it because it was so ridiculously expensive. Since then, Avast has come up with an ultimate package where for a few dollars more than just the antivirus software, you get a whole suite of products, which includes a reconfigured Avast SecureLine, However, the new Avast Secure Line, you have to add it into your browser as an add-in, and I have yet to be able to make it work with any browser, including Avast's own secure browser. So I still keep using the NordVPN because the Avast Secure Line browser just doesn't seem to cut the mustard. So you may still have to use different products from different companies, but the Avast antivirus does not protect you from hacking in a Wi-Fi hot zone.
Another option to do something for free is to use the Opera browser, because it has a VPN-like feature. Essentially it's a VPN, but only within the browser session. And so I used to use it quite regularly to access things like last week tonight or whatever it is with John Oliver, because it was blocked for Canada. And by going in there, you don't have real lot of control. You can go in, you can say you want the default or Europe or North America or something like that. And I found that, strangely enough, Europe usually worked for things that were geo-blocked, like John Oliver's show. But you can try it out for free. The Opera browser is there. So if you turn on if you are blocked from something, you could just turn on the VPN feature in it, which is right on the toolbar, and then try the site again, and you might get the content. So that's something that's available. It's free, unlimited traffic going through their VPN service.
Okay, moving on. A question from Lawrence, who's going to be setting up a powerful Windows 10 machine for network administration type stuff, but he wants to set up a Linux distro to perform additional network monitoring tasks. And he's interested in hearing others' experience and recommendations as he's getting back into Unix, which he hasn't played with for a decade. So, what's a good Linux? Well, basically, if you go to distrowatch.com, you'll find that there are hundreds of distros out there, and they have a top site list, although it's a page hit ranking, so it doesn't actually tell you which are the most popular distros in terms of distros which are being used or distros which have been downloaded. It's basically the pages on DistroWatch that people are coming to view. But I guess that must be correlated to the most popular distros. And interestingly enough, if you look at the top 10 for the last month, you can see at number 8 down here, Linux FX, which is that Windows clone that we were looking at earlier, is in the top 10 list. However, I look a bit higher in the list, basically at number 3. Because my favorite, my current favorite, and in fact I've been using this one for the last 7 years, I looked it up. I started off life with Ubuntu, and it was working well until I ran into a hardware incompatibility. And at the same time, they changed the desktop interface to, I think it was called Unity, which had some awful features which I couldn't live with. So I looked around for a different distro, and I hit on Mint, which is actually an Ubuntu-based distro, and I've been using it ever since. The current version came out just recently. It's a long-term support version, so it's good for the next 5 years. Version 20, and the desktop, as you see it, is that Cinnamon interface, which is kind of their default and the one I've been using. So I'd recommend that one for Lawrence, but I'm sure, well, I'm not sure, maybe other people have some different ideas. So if you have, I don't see anything in, oh, wait a minute. No, I don't see anything in the chat window about Linux distros, but if you have any thoughts, then pass them along.
Lawrence does have a question, which I presume is in terms of Linux Mint. Can you actually make it work with Windows 10's Hyper-V? Is that what you're asking, Lawrence?
Yes, but I have no idea what the answer is. I don't see why not. I mean, Hyper-V is a it's like VirtualBox, right? Where you
yep.
load distros. Yeah. It's basically an Ubuntu distro, so I'm sure it's going to work.
Got it.
Another option, Lawrence, for you might be the Linux subsystem for Windows.
Yeah, that's true, too.
Now, I know nothing about it except how to spell it, but it might be worth looking at.
Agreed. Thank you, Alan.
Okay, I don't see anybody else chipping in with their pearls of Linux wisdom, so we're at that stage in the evening, 10 minutes to go. Anybody else have any other questions, comments, or items that you would like to share in the chat window, or you have to unmute your mic to say something?
Yeah, I think there is... There was something about here. Eldon sent me a private message about being a devout Windows 7 user, reluctant to go to Windows 10. However, it's the way of the world and in the market for a new laptop, wondering when I buy one, is it possible to have a boot up in either both choices, Windows 7, Windows 10? yeah, it is always possible to dual boot operating systems. Sometimes it gets rather finicky about which one gets installed first. Generally speaking, if you start with loading up the oldest version Windows and then install newer versions later, those have, in my limited experience with dual boot, has been the most successful way of going about doing it. Now, there was something else I was saying about on that, too. Oh, yeah, they have to be installed to different partitions.
Just going to say.
So, you know, your drive C might be Windows 7, and then you could install Windows 10 to drive D or something like that. And it should actually build the dual boot menu for you on your – so when you start up, it'll give you the option. But before doing it, I would actually do a bit of Googling on dual boot, Windows 7, Windows 10, and I'm sure there's lots of people out there that have very specific instructions on how to successfully do it. But yes, it can be done. We had a question about what the URL is for TunnelBear, so I posted that into the chat window. A comment from Lawrence that DRM is a bear. Being polite, and I totally agree with that. Anybody who is into digital rights management, it is not for the faint of heart. Can be really, really tricky to work with and to set it up correctly so that it actually does what you think it'll do.
Well, and it was more in reference to the commentary going back and forth in regards to the what shows are available on the U.S. Netflix versus Canada Netflix.
Oh, that, okay. Yeah.
I mean, digital rights management affects a wide variety of things. And long story short, if the licensee has decided for whatever reason that they do not want their content to be displayed in a specific geographical region, that's what happens.
Yeah.
Even if you absolutely love the content.
Agreed.
The only other, well, the comment, I've been, this isn't self, sorry, it was suggested that I make mention this to the, today's session and next week's meeting, that I just had Bridget help me post a latest fraud alert, and there was a very interesting article with plenty of examples of the various baddies type of not malware. I mean, it's stuff that is meant to scam. It's meant to, there's stuff there that's meant to inject malware, whatever. It is there to make you the victim. And they have this document. It isn't too many pages, but it has some very good examples of the type of content to be watchful for. And it has at the end of the document a number of useful advice. And it's advice that you hear over and over again. But as I say to anyone that listens, is that it's good to remind ourselves that there are too many people that are looking to make victims of us all. And it's best for us to be aware as much as possible.
We have about 5 minutes, Chris. There was a question here from Glenn, which you've replied to in the chat window. Do you need a VPN for security if you're only using Chrome? Because that's already encrypted when it's in a public Wi-Fi hotspot.
Yeah, so essentially that comes down to the fact that if all you're worried about is encryption and you are using only a browser, is the only traffic you're worried about, then almost all websites now are HTTPS. But certainly if you are on a site that is HTTPS session, you have an encrypted tunnel between your computer and the server at the other end for that session. Realize that it is only that session, and there can be lots of other traffic that is going from your computer to elsewhere. And so if you're worried about encryption overall, then yes, you would need to do a VPN. If all you're worried about is that one browser session, then no, a VPN doesn't really add anything by double encrypting it.
But to Chris, to add to your point, if you're at a public hotspot, even though your browser traffic is encrypted, the issue isn't so much that. It is the fact that if a baddie happens to be on the same network and they understand that you're going to your favorite banking site or whatever, if they can try to supersede that traffic to a fake banking site. Let's take an obvious example. So what you're going to a public wireless, and if you use it frequently and you're concerned about security, then yes, a VPN will be the way to protect you. Because the built-in browser security between you and the hosting, the website host, is only going to do so much to protect you from someone that is trying to play the man in the middle trick.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%.
Can I ask about the VPN specifically for Netflix? The reason I was looking a while ago was I share, anyways, it's, I guess, problematic, an account with someone in the States. And so it's her name on it. So it's an American account. And I can't log in through my computer from Canada. It keeps flipping me back to the Canadian site. I can do it through Bell 5. I can do it elsewhere, but not on my computer. The ISP, I don't know, just won't let me. So I was looking for a VPN, and I saw all these complaints on all these different VPN sites saying Netflix still recognized that they're not in the right place, and it was useless. And so I'm just wondering if anyone knows of any VPN that is not a problem that way.
Well, as Bob Walker pointed out, the likelihood is that if they want to badly enough, they can determine that you are on VPN, if for no other reason, that from a single IP address, they are getting 10,000 connections coming in. Well, the only way that that's going to likely happen is if you have a VPN involved. And so they might detect it that way. They might keep a list of known IP addresses used by VPN providers. So it would be a moving target, I think. And so I think anyone could work one day, and then maybe the next day, for geo-blocking reasons, it might still be blocked. So I don't think there's a magic bullet on there that will say that, oh, yes, if you buy this, then you'll always be good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, because, yeah, some people were saying they got it just for that, paid the money, and it was useless. You didn't know in advance. So I don't really want to do that.
I don't blame you.
Okay, I'll just stick with Delphi. Thanks.
Okay, so a couple of reminders before we finish. Next week, of course, will be our first regular monthly meeting of the fall session. So September the 9th, Wednesday, 7:30. And we will have a presentation on the Raspberry Pi by a speaker coming to us from Victoria, BC. So it will be a Zoom conference. And following that, we'll have our Q&A session after the main presentation. And the other thing that's going to happen in September, in 2 weeks, is the library's Tech Cafe sessions are starting up again. And Chris has one on the 14th at 10 in the morning, on Windows Performance Tune-Up. And so if you want to see that, remember you have to register with the library, and then they will send you the Zoom login criteria so you can join the presentation. And finally, as I said, our next Q&A will be on September the 9th, but it will be following the Raspberry Pi session and the regular meeting. But as usual, if you have questions or you have suggestions or you have topics that you want to share with other people, please send them along to our suggestion box address. And that's it for me, Chris.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I could do the Windows calculator if people wanted it to run. It would be less than 5 minutes. Or I can save it for next week.
Oh, go on. If it's 5 minutes, let's go for it.
Okay, let's go for it then. Okay, so I'm going to take over the share screen. And calculator. Okay, so when you first run Windows Calculator, this is what comes up. And it's a very, you know, pretty basic looking calculator. Works. No problem with that. It has a history function, which is kind of nice that you can see past calculations, but pretty boring. You can go on there and go to a scientific calculator, and that gives you some additional functionality in that. But what I think a lot of people don't realize that is that it actually goes well beyond that. If I click on here, I can do a graphing, and I've never understood the graphing functions, but if you're into graphing various mathematical functions, you can go in there and do that. There is a programmer's calculator that can do bin and the hex codes and everything like that. I'm going to come down to the converter, and you could do things like volume conversions. And so I could convert from, you know, U.S. cups to, you know, cubic feet if I wanted. And all I do is type in a number, and it gives me the calculation, the conversion, which is kind of neat. And you can do length, and there's a whole bunch of different lengths in there that you can do from nanometers up to, you know, like nautical miles and things like that. Weights, temperature, energy, and then there's a couple of others that are really kind of cool. Currency. So it can come in here, and I use this very frequently. So if I see something on a website that's a U.S. website and it's $49.95, I can just type in $49.95, and I have it converted to 65.18 Canadian. And you'll notice here, and it tells you when it last updated it. And so it updated it today at 8:33, so it looks like when it loaded calculator, it said, oh, I'm out of date on it, so it immediately went out and got a conversion factor, but you can always force an update to it there. And you have all the different currencies around the world that you can convert. So I find that to be really handy. The last thing that I find to be really handy is date calculations. And so, you know, I can come in here and I can say, well, how many days has it been since you know, July 1st or something like that. So I can come into here and say July 1st and to September 2nd, it's 2 months, 1 day, or 63 days. You know, or I could calculate the number of days it's been since I was born, or you can come into here and you can add or subtract days. So I can say July 1st, I want to add, what if I add, 1 year, 4 months, and 4 days? Well, that brings me to November 5th, 2021. So I think the calculator actually is something that a lot of people never really delve into for all of these other things. And I think that it's a marvelous piece of code that is included with every version of Windows 10. And they keep adding new functionality to it. Date calculation was a relatively recent addition to it. And so try it out. You might find that it is more useful than doing just calculations. Any questions on using calculator?
How many bathtubs in 3 liters? Did it have bathtubs for volume? I love that.
Oh, did it?
Yeah.
Oh, I guess that's hilarious. Where was it? Pieces, quarts, gallons.
It's sort of a light on somewhere.
Oh, really? Okay. I don't know. Anyhow, I think calculator is pretty cool. I think it does a really good job. So that's my share for the presentation. And if there are any last questions.
I just have a comment if you can.
Sure.
Alan and Chris, you guys have put on a fantastic show this summer. I mean, I really, really, really can't say thank you enough to you and all the other people there. You guys just paint a completely incredible picture for us this year. So I know you put a lot of work into it, comes through, and I, for one, and I'm sure everybody else here will agree, it's just been a ray of light every Wednesday night. So,
well, thank you, Alan.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I must hand the credit to Alan, because when he first said he wanted to do this weekly, I thought, oh, my God, no. But we've had enough interest that we've kept it going. And as long as the interest continues, I think Alan and I are both happy to keep hosting it.
We keep thinking we're going to run out of questions, but we haven't so far.
That's right. Usually our additional share items, they get pushed off month after month because we fill up the hour with interesting questions from the audience. So that's great.
We'll keep the questions and answers coming.
Yes, by all means.
Okay, thanks very much, everyone.
Okay, thanks, folks. I will stop the recording.